Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. Hey guys, before we get started today, I wanted to let you know that we're not yet done with our series on the forest and fiction. A friend of mine, whom I often encounter while walking in the woods with my dog, asked me what I had learned from this series. So what does this tell us about how humans relate to the forest, he asked me. The truth is I need some time to process this, and we need to get to some more recent books as well. Richard Powers' The Overstory comes to mind, but there are others as well. By the way, I did reach out to Richard Powers, and he kindly responded to my email by saying he would love to talk to me, but doesn't get much reception where he lives in southern Appalachia. But I have some other ideas. I'm going to take some time off this summer, and we'll pick up this thread in the fall. But before I do that, I have a few more episodes for you, beginning with this one. I was excited when I found out that Doug Tallamy has a new book on oak trees, as I've long had a bit of a thing about oaks. Doug tells me he's discovered a lot of people do. Perhaps this is not surprising. In William Bryant Logan's book, Oak, the Frame of Civilization, he writes simply, "No tree has been more useful to human beings than the oak. The strong, hard wood of oaks has been a primary building material for thousands of years. It was used to build Viking longships, half-timbered houses, barrels for everything from wine to whiskey. Oak gall ink was used in many famous documents from the Bible to Leonardo da Vinci's drawings. And in case you're wondering what an oak gall is, stay tuned. Native American tribes and perhaps people all over the Northern Hemisphere depended on acorns as a staple of their diet. The Druids were thought to venerate oaks and may have taken their name from them. And surely all of us in the Northern Hemisphere have been under the spell of a large old oak, as they can live to be hundreds and in some cases thousands of years old. But Tallamy's book isn't about what oaks have done for us humans, but what they do for other creatures. In The Nature of Oaks, Doug Tallamy follows the year in the life of an oak tree, which intersects with the lives of many other beings who depend on oaks for their survival. We begin in October, when the acorns are ripe, with a puzzle. How were white oak seedlings popping up in the Tallamy's yard when there was no white oak nearby? The answer, it turns out, is the blue jay, who carries acorns far and wide and buries them one at a time in various parts of his winter territory. A single jay, writes Tallamy, can gather and bury up to 4,500 acorns each fall, but it typically remembers where only a quarter of them are buried before springtime. So it turns out that jays render service to oak trees, just as the trees feed the jays. This is one of many complex relationships that we learn about in Tallamy's book. Many of you will remember Doug Tallamy from previous episodes of In the Weeds. He's a professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware, and for many years has studied interactions between plants and insects and the impact of these relationships on biodiversity. In my very first episode, I talked to him about his groundbreaking book, Bringing Nature Home. And in episode 17, we discussed Nature's Best Hope, in which he introduces the idea of a homegrown national park, comprised of all of our gardens and private spaces stitched together to form corridors of wilderness across the United States. One of the wonderful things about Tallamy's books are the photographs. It's hard to appreciate just how incredible these insects and other creatures are without seeing them. And Doug photographs many of them on his own property. Luckily, Doug was kind enough to let me use some of his photos to help you follow along. So if you go to my website, in-the-weeds.net, and I'll put the full address in the episode notes, you can follow along with some images of the things that we discuss. All right, let's get to your book. So what inspired you to write this book?
It's a process. I've been studying plant-insect interactions most of my life. And it's led me through the Bringing Nature Home and Nature's Best Hope books, recognizing that our plant choices in our human-dominated landscapes are having a huge impact on the biodiversity around us. And because we're favoring ornamental plants from other continents, mostly Asia, we're devastating the biodiversity. So we looked into, what are the best native plants in terms of supporting biodiversity? How do you support food webs best? So that was a long research project, but it turns out that caterpillars support food webs the best. They're transferring more energy from plants to other animals than not just any other insect, any other animal, period. So what is making the most caterpillars? Well, it's oaks. They support 950 species of caterpillars nationwide, and there's no other plant genus that comes close to that. They're the best carbon sequesterers. They're great at managing our watersheds because of their huge root systems. The only thing they don't do better than almost any other plant is support pollinators because they're wind pollinated. But, you know, 3 out of 4 is pretty good. And I realize people don't know that. And they see the tree in their yard as a tree. And most people just see it as a decoration. Well, it's much more than that. It's a home. It's an entire community of living things. So the book was designed to, again, another attempt to educate the public, give them the information they need. You know, knowledge generates interest and interest generates compassion. And we need a lot more compassion for nature these days. So give them the information they need so they can interact with their oak every month of the year and become connected to the natural world right in their yard. And if they don't have an oak, they can put it in and create a natural setting right in their yard. There's power here. So it was designed to do all that.
Well, I think it's very effective. You know, my kids lately have been wanting to watch David Attenborough documentaries. Uh-huh. And I've been telling them that there is an entire David Attenborough documentary waiting to be made in the oak tree right outside the window.
Excellent. Good. Yeah.
I mean, it's really amazing. I have been trying to educate myself, and I feel sometimes like sort of a second grade level reading ability in terms of my plant literacy, you know? So when I walk around the forest now, on the forest floor, I actually recognize the majority of the plants that I see. But after reading your book, it was like you peeled away yet another layer of things that, you know, are there and that we don't see.
That's another thing, that if we look at the education, particularly of us older folks, you know, we were taught none of this. The word ecology didn't even exist, and you certainly didn't learn about it in school. So the ecological IQ of a huge portion of the U.S. public is about a 1 on a scale of 1 to 10. And it's not that we're stupid. We just were never taught. So it's never too late. You know, get people to realize that it's out there and it's not optional. We depend on it.
Yeah. Yeah,
we
absolutely.
We can't let it disappear. And that's the problem. We're letting it disappear because of that ignorance. So
I was very struck also by the structure of your book. So you organize it by dedicating one chapter to each month of the year, beginning with the month of October. It felt very pandemic appropriate to me somehow, like very, you know, being in the here and now. Was there a relationship between that, or was that just coincidental?
No, because, you know, you write a book, then you get it to the publisher. They hold it for a year and edit it, and then they take another year to publish it. So I actually wrote it 2 years before the pandemic. I didn't know there was a pandemic.
But what was your thinking in terms of choosing to go through the course of the year like that?
Because the community of living things on the oak changes throughout the year. So just describing something on an oak, that's what's there today. What's going to be there tomorrow or next week? And because it's so dynamic, I decided to organize it by month. And everybody says, why'd you start in October? And the answer is, that's when I decided to do this. So I just looked at the, when is it? It's October, we'll start then. And it turns out October, you know, that's, we've got all the acorns. A lot of things are happening. So it was a good month to start with, but there's no great plan behind it. If I started in January, when not much is happening, it'd be a boring start to the book. So
just to give us a baseline, let's talk a little bit about the year in terms of the growth of the oak itself. So in April, roughly, sort of early spring is when it sets seed, right? And the oak tree has both male and female flowers, but it depends on other trees for pollination, by wind pollination. Am I getting that right?
Yes, pretty much. The male catkins come out first, then the female flowers on any given individual. So it's not that the pollen from a single tree can't pollinate a female from that tree. It's just that there are very few female flowers on that tree when the male's pollen are out.
Oh, so it's a timing issue.
It's a timing issue, but on purpose. I mean, they stagger the sexes so that you don't get a lot of internal fertilization. And, you know, you say April, it depends on where you are. Most of the oak pollination actually occurs where I live in May. So April, you get the first bud break, and maybe the end of April, you get some catkins coming out. But of course, as you go further south, it'll be earlier.
Okay. And then the leaves come out, then you have the tender leaves. And as the leaves develop, they become bigger and tougher, which is one of the things that is important in your book in terms of the interactions with various insects. And then, of course, by the time you get to late summer, fall, is when the acorns mature. And then one of the things that distinguishes oaks from some other trees is that although the leaves do change color and die, they don't necessarily fall off the tree, or depending on the maturity of the tree, right?
Right. It's particularly true in the white oak group, and that's called marcescence, where they're holding their dead leaves. And you're right, the juvenile leaves are held more than mature leaves. So the leaves on the lower branches, and of course on a young tree, all the leaves are on lower branches. And the hypothesis is that it was a mechanism to minimize browsing by the huge mammals that were here not very long ago. If you surround those tender buds that they want to eat, the giant sloth and the mammoths and all kinds of things, it's not a very tasty. They couldn't get at the buds without getting a mouthful of dead leaves. And they also couldn't do it without making noise. You rustle those dead leaves, and all of a sudden where you are is very apparent. And because predation was a big thing back then, you had to pay attention or you got eaten. That's the idea anyway. And it's the distribution of the marcescent leaves supports that very well, because they only go up about 18 feet, which is the reach of the giant sloth and some of those, I can't remember if they're mammoths or mastodons, but there were three species alone in Mexico. So, I mean, there were a lot more of these guys around than we think. But when you get above that, there are no marcescent leaves because nobody could reach up there. There's no reason to protect your buds. So
it makes a good shield for the squirrels who live in our pin oak.
It's actually it's a landscaping tool now, because here's a deciduous tree that you actually can use as a screen, because there's only about a month of the year where it drops those marcescent leaves before the other leaves come out. The rest of the time it's blocking the view, and that's hard to do when you're a deciduous tree. So
yeah, that's a good point. All right, so let's get to some of the creatures that live on oak trees. When we view an oak tree from a distance, as we are generally inclined to do, we think oak tree. But in fact, there's an entire ecosystem that depends on the tree and on pretty much every piece of that tree. And you go into detail about a lot of these creatures in your book, and some of them are just utterly fascinating. So I was wondering if we could highlight some of the ones that struck me in particular, and you know, feel free to bring up ones that you think I'm overlooking. So let's begin with the acorn weevils and the, I'm going to mispronounce this, but the
Temnothorax ants.
Who live in the acorns, or who depend on the acorns for their survival. So can you tell us a little bit about them?
Yeah, we'll start with the acorn weevil. Weevils, of course, have those big long, it's an extension of the head cap, so people think it's a nose, but the mouth parts are at the end of that extension, and that allows them to chew a hole down into the center of the acorn. Then the female turns around and lays an egg in that hole, and that's how the larva gets down into the center of the acorn, where it develops, and now it's safe. No parasitoid can reach it, and the predators can't reach it. So it develops, completes its development as a larva, and then it tunnels out of the acorn and then pupates underground. When it tunnels out, of course, it has hollowed out some of the acorn, not all of it. Depending on the size of the acorns, they can actually germinate even after they've had an acorn weevil in them. But they do make a little cavity in there where they've eaten, and then they tunnel out and leave a very nice hole. Well, these Temnothorax ants, there's three species of them. They take advantage of little holes, but they love the vacated holes made by acorn weevils in acorns. And they will move the entire colony into that brand new acorn, because the acorn they're living in now is falling apart. The acorns only last, you know, at the most 10 years, 2 years. And they want to find a new acorn. So they're very excited if they find a new one, and they can move the entire colony into the new one in about 30 minutes. And then they guard the entrance, make sure nobody else comes in, and they will live there until that acorn falls apart, which is, again, about 2 years later. So I use it as an example of just one of the millions of very specialized relationships that are nature out there. well, it starts with the tree making a tasty fruit. And acorn weevils are very common, by the way, on some trees in some circumstances. 90% of the acorns can have an acorn weevil. They like red oak acorns because they're pretty big. I don't want to speak beyond my knowledge here. I'm sure they're in the white oak group too, but I always find them in the bags of red oak acorns. White oak acorns germinate in the fall. So they fall from the tree and they germinate right away. And that might discourage the use of the acorns by the weevils because they don't have time to develop before they actually germinate.
And of course, oaks have these mast years. So some years produce a lot more acorns than others. Is there any indication ahead of time of when there's going to be a mast year or not? Or is it just, you know, serendipitous, as it were?
It depends on how much ahead of time. I can look at a tree in July and say, well, that's loaded. That's going to be a mast year. But no, I get that question a lot. How do we know when a mast year is coming? And the answer is we don't. It's unpredictable. I think there's so many variables involved. The tree only has a finite amount of energy. So it either grows or it produces a lot of acorns, but it can't do both at the same time. So it depends on its energetic history. When's the last time it masted? Although you get great synchronization in masts. The mast we had in 2019 went from Massachusetts to Georgia all the way to the Mississippi, all synchronized. So that's not just who masted last. I mean, they all got together. That was within the red oak group. Weather has something to do with it because they drop the catkins. And when the pollen is being released, if it's very rainy or if you have a late frost, and we've had a couple late frosts this year, it wrecks reproduction that year. So that's not going to be a mast year, even if the oak wanted to do it. So there's some dependence on the weather. But how many years in between? It's complicated because you would think if it's simply a nutritional thing, then it'd be highly variable. Oaks in very nutrient-rich soil would be able to mast more often, but I don't think they do. So, and then there's the pollen synchronization hypothesis, where if they all release their pollen at once, then fertilization success is going to be much, much higher. But cross species will mast. So there were several members of the red oak group that masted at the same time in 2019. What was special about 2019? I don't know. But the ultimate reason that most people agree on is that it swamps the acorn predators. So you've got the acorn weevil, you've got all those mammals and birds that love acorns. If the trees all produce at a regular rate, the populations of those things that depend on them would stabilize around that rate, and they'd eat all of the acorns. It'd be very hard for the tree to actually reproduce. So just like the cicadas coming out this year, you produce more than the predator population can handle, and then there's excess.
So let's talk about cicadas. So do cicadas like oaks in particular, or are they more generalists?
They're generalists, but they love oaks. They love oaks. A single oak, a large oak, can have 20,000 cicadas on its roots.
Wow.
And what's interesting is you can't measure any impact on the tree. They're sucking xylem. They're plugging into the xylem tubes. And what's in xylem is mostly water. So it's water with a little bit of nutrients in there. Not much at all. And that's why they can, as long as there's not a serious drought, they can suck on the tree and the tree just hardly notices. So that's pretty neat. It takes them a long time, but it's pretty neat that you can produce that much biomass with that little amount of effect on the trees. Plants are gathering energy from the sun and using, you know, they're converting that energy using carbon dioxide from the air into food. But there's a lot of carbon dioxide in the air, particularly these days, and they actually produce more carbon than they can use. And that's what's fueling the growth of the cicadas and the other things. What's always in short supply is nitrogen. And that is a limiting factor. But there's plenty of carbon to go around. You can build a cicada body without the tree even noticing it.
I mean, it's amazing how many things grow as a function of these trees. So also on my list is oak galls. So describe what they are and who makes them.
Little wasps in the family Cynipidae. They're called gall wasps. There are about 5,000 species of gall wasps worldwide. Most of them, I think it's at least 80%, are oak specialists. They do make galls on a few other things, but most of them are making galls on oaks. There can be 70 species of galls on a single oak tree. I've never seen that, but that's what I read. But you get a lot of species on a single tree. And they're all, I mean, talk about specialized interactions. It's a parasitic interaction, but those are the most specialized. And, you know, they've been around for millions of years. The tiny little wasps come out and they will lay their eggs in the meristematic tissue of the oaks, just as the bud is starting to expand. And when they lay their eggs, they're injecting plant hormones in a species-specific way, with a species-specific formula, into that meristematic tissue and shaping it into the gall that defines that species. And the larva of the wasp develops in the center of that gall. So the apple oak gall, for example, is this big, but the larva is a little dot in the center, and it, all in between is air. It's hollow. And you say, well, why make a gall that big? Because the enemies of the galler have long ovipositors and they want to lay eggs in the galler. So the gall is designed to separate the space from where the parasitoid is on the outside of the gall to where the galler is on the inside of the gall, so that their ovipositor can't reach it. For some reason, gall wasps have more parasitoid enemies than any other insects. So many things, Clara. I guess it's because they're all in one place. They're, you know,
sitting targets.
They're targets, right?
Yeah.
But it's complicated because they have alternation of generations. So one generation is parthenogenetic. They're all females. They don't need males. They produce a generation that is sexual, has both males and females. And that comes out in the middle of the summer. And that generation makes different galls, and the adults look entirely different. So you would think they're totally different species. And they figured out they were the same species before DNA. So I still marvel at that because you get totally different galls with different looking wasps. Why would you ever think they're the same species? And I guess because of rearing, they kept rearing them. But it is all the same species, and it's really complicated, intricately dependent on each other. One interesting fact that I didn't put in the book because I didn't even learn about it is that there's a particular gall. I've got it on my tree, but it's very common in Europe as well, that if you grind it up and you add this chemical and that chemical, it makes ink. And that was the ink that most of human history has been written with. The Magna Carta was written with gall ink. The Declaration of Independence was written with gall ink. The Bible was written with gall ink. So galls have played an important part in the recorded history of mankind.
That's fascinating. So caterpillars are obviously very important to what you write about. And there was one that uses... It secretes something and then it uses ants as part of its sort of bodyguards and then it descends into the litter during the daytime and then climbs back into the tree at night. Can you tell us about that? Because I found that one fascinating.
Right. There are several hair streaks that do that to a varying degree. Hair streaks are they're butterflies. They're not moths. And some of them eat the green leaves. So the one you were talking about will eat green leaves during the night, but then they hide in the leaf litter during the day. Others eat just dead leaf litter, and you never see them. The banded hair streak, for example. So try to find those larvae. I've never found them, but they're there. You see the adults pretty commonly. But then there are others with even more intricate associations with ants, where the ants are carrying them back and forth, and the ants carry them to these little, there's a name for it, but it's a chamber in the leaf litter and guard them, and that's where they pupate and then emerge. Ants have close relationships with lots of insects that way because it's a mutualism. These lysinid larvae, they produce amino acids and a gland on their thorax. And it's nitrogen, and it's a valuable food source for the ants, and the ants will treat them just like cattle. I mean, they guard them, they get food from them every day, they make sure nobody hurts them, move them to where they need to be. There's some very complicated interactions with endangered butterflies in Europe based on ants. They're lysinids as well. They're not on oak trees. They're on lupines, I think. But you need the plant, you need the ant, and you need the caterpillar. And it's hard to get all three together these days. So that's why they're endangered. But
okay, there's one more specific insect I want to talk about before I ask some more general questions, although we could keep going. But and that's the tree crickets that use holes in the leaves to amplify their voices. Or voice is not quite the right word, but their sound.
Their sound, right. Yeah, you can watch this in September. You can go out, you can hear them. It's a high buzzing, and you just follow it. And here's the male with his head stuck through the hole and his wings are up. And there's varying degrees of that. As you move further south, the crickets seem to get smarter. If they don't find a hole the right size, they chew their own hole and create it, which is pretty common down in the tropics. I've seen that in Costa Rica. Up here, for the most part, they're using holes that already exist. But the, you know, the louder the sound, the more likely it is it will attract a female. Females are judging male quality by how loud a voice they have, because that indicates male size, and male size is a measure of genetic quality. So they cheat. We'll amplify our sound and sound as big as possible, whether we're big or not. And this female doesn't seem to know the difference. So
clever. I just love, my husband is a musician, not professionally, but he does record, and he's fascinated by sound in general, by acoustics. And so I took a picture of that page from your book and sent it to him. I thought that was something that would really strike him. I mean, sound is just so fascinating, the way it works in general. So we talked a bit about the caterpillars that go down into the leaf litter. You make the point that there's actually more life at the base of the tree than in the tree itself.
Well, you know, we're talking about more life in the soil, including the leaf litter, than above the ground. Mm-hmm. And that's true both in terms of number of species and number of individuals. It's not true in terms of biomass, because the creatures above ground are bigger, but there are a lot of creatures in the soil, Columbalans and Proturans and Diplurans and all the predators and, you know, thousands of species of mites. These are multicellular. We're not getting into the bacterium, which nematodes. It's a very complex community. They're all the detritivores that are recycling the nutrients or the things that eat those detritivores. They all require high humidity, and that's the value of leaf litter, in that it is their food, and they're recycling the nutrients in those leaves down to the plant roots. So you never have to fertilize your plant if you don't remove the leaf litter, because those things will all turn it over. And then the leaf litter also maintains the humidity that entire community depends on. It prevents soil erosion. It prevents soil compaction, along with the canopy of the tree. You know, when it pounds rain, it hits those leaves and the branches and everything, and then it just drips down onto the ground, no matter how strong the storm is. And so soil under a tree is not compacted, and soil outside can be compacted just by rain alone.
And you said that oak leaf litter is exceptionally good. And that's because of the toughness of the oak leaves in particular?
It's because it lasts the longest, mm-hmm. Yes. A single oak leaf can take 3 years to completely break down, whereas a leaf from a tulip tree or a maple or a birch, they don't even make it through the summer, for one summer.
Right.
So if you have a maple forest, you typically have bare soil before it's the end of August. And bare soil is not a good thing. So the more oaks we have in our forest, the better it is for the soil. And that's an issue, because we now have 50% fewer oaks than we had a century ago, because of the way that we're managing our forests and the fact that they're great wood. We cut them down. And now with too many deer, they're not regenerating. So the blue jay buries the acorn, the acorn germinates, and then the deer comes and eats it and leaves the multiflora rose and the autumn olive and the burning bush and all the invasives. So you end up with no understory of the canopy trees that need to replace our forest giants that are dying. So
that brings me to a practical question. I take my dog every morning to hike in a local patch of woods. So I did a sort of an informal inventory of the oaks there this week with a friend. And there are some very tall old oaks. And at first I couldn't see any baby oaks, but then when I looking more closely, there actually were quite a few, especially really young ones, and then some that were more of the understory level. But I'm wondering if there's a role to be played there by conservationists to protect them against the deer. I mean, obviously you can't go and protect every little oak sapling, but I feel protective of those oak saplings now. Yeah. Like, should I be going in there and like spraying deer fence on them? Should I go talk to the town board about, you know, fencing them in? Or
yeah, it's a huge problem. If you spray that stuff on the oak, you will keep the deer off temporarily, but you'll also keep all the things that need that oak off too. So you're ruining its ecological value, but you're keeping it alive. So that's something.
Yeah.
Well, that's what we had to do at our house. You know, we've got 10 acres. It was mowed for hay. All the oaks that are here now are ones that I put a cage around because they wouldn't be here. And you know, that it's that simple. It's much simpler than fencing the 10 acres, which would keep the deer out, but we didn't do that.
All right. So here's another practical question. I have a friend who has, you know, not 10 acres, but probably 2 acres, 1.5 acres, something like that. And she just cut down a whole bunch of Norway maples. And so I said, you should plant some oaks. Let me lend you this book. So give us your recipe for planting oaks. You start young, ideally from an acorn. Is that what you would say?
Yes. So there, the upsides is you will get a much healthier tree. It will, in the end, it will grow faster. Its root system will never be disturbed. It's free. That's a big upside for a lot of people. The downsides are, particularly if you're putting it in your yard, people want instant gratification, and an acorn's pretty small. They get impatient the first 2 or 3 years when they're building that root system. They do grow slowly those first few years. Then they take off. The biggest problem is protecting them from all the things that want to eat those acorns over the winter or the young trees. So, you know, if you're starting almost anywhere now, from here to California, there are too many deer. So you really do have to put a cage around it and protect it until it gets going. So, you know, it depends. It depends on your situation. Cost is a factor for a lot of people. They all want to buy a 15-foot oak, which can cost $3,000, but it's got a 50% chance of dying. It's got to be severely root pruned to transplant it. It's a big deal. And in the end, that acorn I plant on the same day will be a better tree and get taller faster than that 15-foot oak that's just going to sit there for a decade trying to rebuild its root system. So I encourage people to go small. Several years ago, I think it was in the parking lot where I give blood, and there were some red oaks that they weren't very big, but boy, they had a mast year that year. And the parking lot was just, it was just, you know, covered with acorns. And I couldn't stand watching the cars crush all these acorns. So I scooped them up and just throwing them in the car. And I didn't have time to deal with any of it. It was the fall, of course. So I came home and I put them all in a bucket and I just walked out and I threw them. That was my contribution to red oaks that year. And I would have bet that none of them would have made it, that the mice and everybody would have gotten them. But I was wrong. Many of those germinated the next spring. And a lot of the red oaks that I have on the property now came from that one afternoon of me throwing oaks out, acorns at. And it took me 10 minutes. So on the other hand, I wanted post oak on my yard. That's a species I don't have. I got some post oak acorns from not far from here. I got 100 of them, and I carefully planted them around the property. I had zero survivorship. The mice got every single one of them. So what I do now is I start it in a pot in the fall. And so red oaks germinate in the spring. You can put them in peat moss in a Ziploc bag in the refrigerator over the winter. You don't have to worry about the mice in that case. And then in the spring, you can plant them, but I still put them in a pot so they can get going with a little root system. And then I transplant that. And that avoids the squirrels and the mice during the acorn issue. But if you put the white oak group, you put that in a pot, you still have to protect them from the mice because they get in that pot and they dig it up and eat it over the wintertime. So somehow you got to make a mouse-proof container. That's the only challenge of going from an acorn, but it is the way to go. And we also talk about creating groves of trees so that when they grow up, their roots are interlocked and they won't blow over and crush your house. And the best way to do that is to start very young so that roots can intertwine as they're developing. It's hard to get older trees to do that. So that, again, you start with an acorn or a 2-foot bare root whip costs $1.50. And it comes with no roots at all, but it grows them very quickly. And I've had a lot of success with them. They'll form that oak grove as well. So you're sacrificing the, everybody pictures that oak in the field, the giant spread. That's when everybody wants that in their yard. You're sacrificing that look for a group of two or three that are going to grow together, but they're not going to fall over. And in these days with erratic weather and polar vortexes and derechos, that's the one everybody worries about, derechos. It's worth it to a lot of people to do that. And it creates good habitat too.
And you make the point too, that in terms of carbon sequestration, that oaks are really a good bet because they live so long.
They're very dense. So the denser the wood, the more carbon it's created from. Something that most people don't appreciate is, yes, the value of the tree in terms of building its tissue out of carbon and holding it for as long as it lives is important. But even the trees that live 3,000 years eventually die and release that carbon back up into the atmosphere. The more important value of trees and plants, prairie plants in particular, is that they're constantly leaving carbon in the soil. They build these mycorrhizal associations with the root tips that are growing and dying all the time as the tree roots move on. And it's a product called glomalin, that as they move along, the glomalin is left behind. The glomalin is made out of carbon, and that's what makes our soils brown or black. And that, once it's in the soil, is stable until you turn the soil over. So, you know, tens of thousands of years, it's in the soil, out of harm's way. And that's the real benefit of putting plants on our properties, other than lawn, that are going to put that carbon into the soil. As long as we don't get the rototiller out and then turn it over, because as soon as you do that, 70% of it goes up into the atmosphere. So oaks, because of their big root system, make a lot of glomalin, and they're depositing, you know, tons of carbon in the ground, in addition to the big, you know, storage factories that their bodies are.
Because their root systems are often even bigger than what we see above ground. Is that right?
Much bigger.
Much bigger, right.
I tell the story of the group that was digging up. It was one of the king's oaks, Crocus robur in England. And they wanted to see how far out the roots went. And they went 300 feet from the center of the tree, and they gave up. They got tired of digging. So they don't stop at the drip line. That's what we always thought. But they go much farther than that. But, you know, in suburbia, they hit a street, they hit a sewer line, they hit your foundation. There's a lot of things preventing proper root growth.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to encourage people very much to read the book, not only because it's a wonderful read, but also because the pictures are such a big part of the story as well. I mean, it's really startling. I mean, one that comes to mind is the spun glass moth, for instance.
That's my favorite.
it's really stunning.
It's incredible. Yeah.
And, you know, to think that all of these creatures are there. Oh, there was one other thing I wanted to ask you about, the various kinds of camouflage that various insects are able to produce, and hiding tricks, using threads to stack leaves together so they can hide in between. I found that really interesting as well.
Right. Or hanging, go out at night under your oak with a flashlight and look at all the caterpillars that are hanging from threads. Some of them just spend the entire night that way because there's so many things hunting up on the leaves that it's the only safe place to be. But others, a lot of caterpillars eat the leaves at night, but when a parasitoid comes along, they can feel it on the leaf. They'll tumble off the edge and hang on their silken rope. But some parasitoids, some braconids are even smarter. They will pull the rope up with their first pair of legs, pull it all the way up, and then lay an egg in it. Or they'll shinny down the rope and lay an egg in it. So it's a tough life out there being a caterpillar. But
it's like the Serengeti or something in terms of the prey, you know, predator interactions. A lot of drama.
A lot of drama, yes.
One last question. What are you looking for right now? So we are mid-May at the moment. What kinds of things are you looking for in your oak trees at the moment?
The migrating birds. Most of the caterpillars that are out there are fairly small. But this is when the migrants come through, and it's not a coincidence that they time their migration with the, you know, the flush of those brand new leaves. And you've got a great flush of caterpillars, particularly in the family Geometridae, the inchworms. They're soft. They taste good. There's no chemical defenses. And they will go to the oaks first. So all good birders know you look in oaks for migrants. And then if they're not there, you're probably not going to find them anywhere, but you know, you go to other trees. So this is right when they're moving through our property, and that's what we're looking for. So now for the next month is probably the hardest time to find caterpillars, because the birds are reproducing and they get them all. You know, they are very good at finding them, much better than we are. So,
okay, I'll get my binoculars. I have to look high up is the only problem. I hope you enjoyed this episode. A reminder, if you haven't already listened to my earlier interviews with Doug Talamy, go back and listen to episode 1 and episode 17. Next time, a conversation with Margaret Grebowitz about mountaineering and what this extreme sport tells us about human desire and our relationship to the natural world. If you have a moment, please leave a positive review for In the Weeds on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Thanks a lot.